American Francophilia, I don't know too much. It has demonstrated itself abundantly in architecture with people like Jefferson and Richardson and Sanford White, and much later, I suppose, Michael Dennis. I know it in that kind of area. And then I can think of a number of quotes which testify to English regard for Francophilia. There is, for instance, that nice quote from Edmund Burke, Anglo-Irish and great patriot who hated the French Revolution, but who wrote before that, "London is but a sun shone upon by the moon of Paris." I tend to think that's true, very often at least. Then there's also the American actress in who's supposed to have said, "Oh, you'll just love London, it's so convenient for Paris." And then there is that 19th century English, it must be an English, a 19th century verse, it's certainly English, "The French have taste in all they do, which we are quite without, for while in all things they show goût, they leave us only gout." I think this must relate to the excessive consumption of the wines of Bordeaux in England in the 19th century. Now, it's at that stage that I had thought of ending, but I was involved in a lunch for tonight's speaker, and with Dominic La Capra and Martin Kubelik talking about important present-day French intellectuals, I felt, as I think did John Miller, like one of those hicks from the sticks. But I remembered what I read in my diary this morning, and Amy told me that this would be a lifesaver, and so I think it is. I looked in my diary, and it said that today, October the 14th, was first of all the anniversary of the birth of Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1890 in Denison, Texas, just across the tracks from Jerry Wells. And whether that is important or not, I do not know. It's curious. Anyway, it's also the 916th anniversary of the Battle of Hastings, where William of Normandy conquered, thank God, the English. It depends how you feel about that, whether you are a repository of Anglo-Saxon sentiment or pro-French sentiment. I feel always in favor of it, and the language that we use would not be available for our use, of course, without that great event. In the same way, then, I want to revert to the architectural language which we use, which I don't suppose would be available to us without the authority of French precedent. Now, the way I'm driving should now be apparent, because it's on this very auspicious day in Anglo-French history that I would like to cast Madame Chauet in the role of an academic Amazon version of William of Normandy. I would like to imagine her initiating a minor cultural conquest at Cornell. I don't think she greatly loves the France of Pompidou and Mitterrand and people of that kind. And correspondingly, I think she's abundantly capable of addressing herself to the sort of topics of French origin which have so long, you know, from Philibert Delorme to Le Corbusier, obsess the attention of at least some architects at Cornell. I commiserate with Madame Chauet in having to speak in this room, and I think she suffers a certain terror and angst at the prospect, but I'm sure it will be all right in the end. Françoise.
Not for knowledge and erudition's sake, but in view of present questions and the present so-called crisis of architecture, or rather of architectural theory. Actually, I don't see how it could be otherwise, because if there's one single certainty acquired by the epistemology of social sciences during the last decades, it is that objective history is an impossible task. The generation, for instance, of the École des Annales, people who are yet who are presently at present well known here, like Braudel, and more recently people who lectured here, like Le Goff, Duby, and Chaunu, all of them, whether they concentrated on quantitative history or on history of mortalities, have shown that the realistic history of the pioneer generation, people of the mid-19th century, like Michelet, and afterwards Mommsen and their followers, was but a utopia. And we are now fully aware that what we call history, and here I'm not meaning chronology, is a biased way of organizing documents which we cannot which we cannot structure, but with the help of the grid of present concepts and preoccupations. In other words, history being interpretation and the projection of specific problems raised now and here, let us deal consciously with these conditions. Actually, the three concepts I'm using in my title stem from such an attitude. Not only do they form an essential part, the three concepts I mean, myth, history, and remembrance, memory. Not only do they form an essential part of present research in social sciences, but it is precisely as such that they will help us to investigate past theories. And definitely our three authors would not have been read and questioned on these purposes, say, for instance, in the 17th or 18th century. The questions raised would have been totally different. Now, why did I choose these three concepts and these three authors? And what kind of relationship does really bind them? What, in other words, what's the meaning of such an apparently queer assemblage? Well, I'll deal first with the concepts, which are all positively or negatively involved with the idea of time. Myth and remembrance have traditionally been associated with two opposite functions and aspects of architecture, a sacred one and a human one, which apparently, and this is important, seem to have disappeared or being suppressed by the theory of architecture. As far as myth is concerned, I am in particular referring to the so-called foundation or origin myth, which accounted for the origin foundation rituals and the specific layout of urban establishments or architectural structures in traditional cultures. According to modern cultural anthropology, and more precisely to Levi-Strauss' interpretation, myth here, in the case of cities and architecture, as when used in reference to all other kinds of human artifacts or practices, is endowed with two functions, a religious one, the better known and most written about, and a speculative one. On the one hand, myth relates building, because we are speaking of building, to the field of the sacred. the vocabulary of Indo-European institutions gives us many clues in that direction, as, for instance, has been shown in Benveniste's remarkable two books on that topic. And let us just for now mention the single word of Aedes, and we will turn to that later. On the other hand, Aedes, which means the word for the human abode in Latin, which begins by being the sea of the gods. On the other hand, myth serves to solve symbolically problems or contradictions of various kinds, which are encountered at various levels of reality. That's the use of what Lévi-Strauss calls the structure feuilletée du mythe. And to my knowledge, up to now, there has been no systematic study of that function in the case of the great foundation, the great Indo-European foundation myth, and that could be a most interesting field of research. Anyhow, the questions I would like to raise in that relation is what has become now, at present, of such a powerful dimension. Has any kind of mythical dimension remained in architectural theory, or has this architectural theory been totally secularized? And in any case, how and why did this process take place? So this is the first series of questions. Now, as far as remembrance or rememoration is concerned, it appears both from the remotest written tradition and from the present studies of archaic cultures to be a fundamental function of buildings. Was not, we know that Daedalus was the patron of architects, and isn't his labyrinth a masterpiece of what Vernon calls cunning, mythic reason, that is, cunning reason? Isn't the labyrinth the tool by par excellence of memorization, involving at once the time and the body? In the light of the labyrinth symbol, architecture appears as a means for individuals as well as social groups to grasp and affirm in opposition to the other and the others their own identity. It supports the constitution of the ego, and it also poses culture as the affirmation of an identity, and in that sense it's not necessarily related to history. This fundamental relationship between memory and architecture, we have some clear evidence in Francis Yates' study, but I shall not dwell longer upon that. So there again, it seems that at present, remembrance and memory plays no part in architectural theories. And one may wonder whether this function has been taken over by other artifacts. Again, we can ask ourselves for what kind of reasons, and that's some of the problems that we shall be asking ourselves later on, remarking that a series of researches in that direction are going on at present in France, and especially in relation to the preservation policies. Now, finally, the third concept, history, or rather history of architecture. Does it not per se eliminate the two other concepts? Does it not, by means of a kind of Hegelian Aufhebung, suppress, integrate, and transcend at the same time the activity of myth and memory, getting rid through a process of rationalization at once of divinities and individualities? History of architecture, actually, is born with theory of architecture, and we must note that they both belong to the same reflexive attitude. So we shall have to dwell on history, which will be at the very center of our analysis with a double orientation. First, we shall try to define its original role in theory. What is the meaning and purpose of history in the first theories of architecture? Then we'll raise the question of its evolution, considering what history has become today, where it doesn't exist anymore as an independent discipline, but has burst out in directions as numerous and varied as are the various social practices, individual and individual social sciences, and even hard sciences. Not only are we today faced, for instance, with history of cooking or history of dying, but history of psychology, of linguistics, of all human sciences, and also of medicine and physics. But we must note that this kind of history plays an important role in the theories of the various aforenamed sciences, and contributes to their development. So we shall therefore be faced in our case, in the case of history and architectural theory, with two questions, among others. The first one will be, was it necessary for architectural theory to integrate architectural history? Was that original relationship a necessary one? And the other question is, has not the present epistemic situation more or less changed the status of history for architectural historians? Now, let me again, before I go ahead, stress the fact that I'm not going to give answers, really, to all these questions, but try and raise them in the best possible way. Now, I have also to justify the choice of my three authors, and there I'll try to answer the questions that you may raise. And there would probably be two main ones. First, why revert to the 50th century of Alberti? I remind you that he died in 1472. And does it really make sense to inquire thus far back into the past? And my second, why select these three writers, seemingly so far apart in time and style and ideas? And And Viollet, Quatre-Mères, who might be not as familiar to you as the others, was lived between 1788 and 1850. And of course, Viollet le Duc, you know about, he died in 1709. So, what apparently the choice of these three people seems arbitrary and perhaps even queer. And so I'll try and answer the first question, which is the reverting back to Alberti. And for since a number of years, when contrasting the modern movement and postmodernism has become a main topic of architectural criticism, and there and also the relation or non-relation with the history has been at the center of the discussion, it has become a habit, if not a fashion, to highlight it by the works of the Enlightenment theoreticians, especially Laugier, and also Quatre-Mères. And it is currently assumed that these texts can cater for all the material needed to understand the origins and meanings of our own problems. And I do not for 1 minute agree with this assumption. Turning back to Alberti is a must, and for a simple reason. He is the first theoretician of the art of building. Building meaning, in his case, single structures as well as cities or even landscapes. He is the one who, for the first time, achieved a true autonomy for the discipline which he thoughtfully called edificatio, and we will come back to this word later. His treatise, which he is supposed to have presented to Pope Nicholas V around 1452, is inaugural. It gives the theoretical discourse on architecture and consequently our relationship with architecture its reflexive dimension. And it enables us to speak of the existence from then on of what I would call a self-conscious architecture. And this is really why this is the text which really contains, for these reasons, in Nucci, some of the most fundamental problems of present-day theory, and the text that we must always revert to. The autonomization of the discipline of edificatio, and I will use this word from now on in order to mean building and building with specific qualifications that I'll mention later on, is this atomization is achieved by which was achieved by Alberti, we must understand, was contemporary of a series of other emancipations and definitions of specific fields of knowledge, and this has been very well described by people like Eugenio Garin, for instance, just to mention one name. And among these fields, there is precisely history. We must remember that nearly a generation before Alberti, Chancellor Bruni, Chancellor of Firenze, achieved for history the status of an original discipline and accomplished this feat by confronting Greece and Florence, realizing at once, in a dialectical process, the two interrelated and necessary operations of distanciation and objectivation, which precisely characterize history in the modern sense of the word. Not only were these operations familiar to Alberti, a connoisseur of Greek, Roman, and Italian history, they were familiar to him in a no more theocentric or anecdotic style, which characterized up to then the relation to the past. But it is precisely this familiarity with the historical approach which enabled him to project distanciation and objectivation over buildings and to consider them as obeying laws and rules in the same way as the other as other creations of the human beings. Of course, Quatremer and Viollet-le-Duc illustrate two further and different stages of the development of history. The first one, and history of art, of course. The first one, as we shall see later on, is, that is, Quatremer, is contemporary of a generalization and a universalization of history and art history, which is not alien to the literature of travels and the works of so-called humanist geographers on the one side, and which is also linked to the progress of archaeology, which nevertheless was still focusing on cultures of the antiquity. As far as Viollet-le-Duc is concerned, he belongs to the positivist period of history and witnesses the elaboration of a systematic historical methodology. As far as architectural history is concerned, its field is no longer restricted in his case and at his time to antiquity. The architecture of the Middle Ages has been discovered, periodized, structurally studied, for instance, by people like de Caumont in the 1820s, and a whole vocabulary has been coined in order to cope with that with that discovery. Case studies have been, at that time, the accomplishment of an amateur generation who taught the first professional academic art historians, who are Viollet-le-Duc's contemporaries. We must note that the Industrial Revolution, or rather its effects upon the urban scene and life, have also immensely contributed to a growing attention paid to the past and to the architecture of the past, and finally resulting in the preservation theories and policies. It's just amazing to see the number of books and publication, historical publication in the field of architecture, which occur at that time. Nevertheless, I assume that these differences between the three historical approaches of our three authors is epistemological rather than epistemic. Which means that whatever the conception and methods or even objects of history and history of architecture, the main fact to me is the historical approach with these two aspects, which I mentioned a minute ago, that means distance and taking distance and objective and making objects of the historical datas.